Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Depression. It's such a common disease today that it's called mental health's common cold. What should you or someone you know do if they've been feeling sad for quite a while? With me to answer that question is a psychiatrist in private practice who specializes in, no surprise, depression. He is a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, lead author of a book just published by W.W. Norton, Challenging Depression. Subtitle, every book's got a subtitle these days, The Go-To Guide for Clinicians and Patients. Dr. Mark Zetton, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. Now, depression, I'll do this. When I was in the shower this morning, I was thinking about this interview coming up. And I was saying, you know, depression is kind of like a headache. You know, it's the symptom. There is 9,000 causes, and people are trying to be treated by one. They try one drug. The doctor tells them to try one drug. If it doesn't work, we'll try another, or we'll try cognitive therapy, or we'll add this, or we'll subtract that. Deep brain stimulation, vagus nerve stimulation. You know, the new magnetic thing that you put around your head for severe. There's like, it's like, it seems like a lot of guesswork, and still a lot of people don't get better. Are we in the voodoo stage in the diagnosis and treatment of depression, or am I, or hopefully you're going to tell me that's not true?
Well, there are a lot of different approaches to depression. You're right about that. But for an expert, there's a systematic approach to diagnosing and treating depression that is systematic, that is stepwise, that categorizes, that looks at which patient would be best matched to which kind of treatment.
Okay, so let's say I start out and I come to you and I'm the patient. And I say, okay, I've been sad for a long time. This isn't just because I lost my job. You know, I've always been kind of a schleppy guy. I've always been a little bit mildly sad. I'm not curled up with a bottle of vodka, but, you know, I'm sad a lot. And if crap happens, you know, I can kind of mire down. And I always feel like I'm this monk who's trudging through life. And, you know, it's affecting my personal relationships and, you know, I'm just not a happy guy, okay? That's the start. That's what I come in with. Now what do you do, Mr. Systematic?
Okay, what I do first is I want to know, do you meet the diagnostic criteria for major depressive disorder?
Go ahead. So what do you do?
So I ask you a bunch of questions.
Ask me a couple. What? Ask me the two or three most critical questions.
Are you finding that you have a persistent depressed mood? And
I said that up front.
Okay. Not enjoying anything?
Most things. Yeah, I enjoy blogging.
Okay. Not sleeping very well, not
I
eating
sleep.
Very well.
I sleep, I eat too much. But yeah. I'm kind of sad all most of the time.
Any thoughts about suicide?
No.
Any problems with your energy?
Not really.
Okay. Feeling worthless or guilty?
Guilty constantly. Worthless, no.
Okay. So you got some of the symptoms of major depression. Now I think about, could it be due to something else? How much are you drinking?
Nothing. Very little.
Any street drugs? Speed, coke, grass?
No.
Okay. And then I'd ask you at other times, do you feel on top of the world? Fantastic. Just tons of energy. Thinking, talking, moving fast. Don't need much sleep.
I'm on this radio. Only when I'm hosting this radio show.
Okay. So I don't.
Which is 1 hour a week. There's 167 other hours.
Okay, so you don't have periods of unusually high mood and energy.
No, I generally tend to be flat most of the time.
And do you have any major medical problems?
By the way, listeners, that question was, of course, was about trying to get at whether it's manic depression rather than depression. Am I correct?
Of course.
Yeah, continue.
Of course.
Yeah, I just want to, but of course for you, but not for our listeners. Okay, go ahead.
So, do you have any major medical problems, illnesses,
Thank
operations?
Thank God, no. That would really make me depressed.
You taking any medicines?
Fish oil and a baby aspirin every day. That's it.
Okay. Those aren't going to cause problems. Have you had a decent physical with a comprehensive lab test?
Yes, I'm a good, yeah, I'm okay.
Okay. So what we've done so far, we have eliminated drug-induced depression. We have eliminated bipolar depression. We're now thinking that it's probably not medically induced because you've had a physical and labs.
Right.
So it's not a medical problem.
Not thyroid, not low testosterone or any of those things, right?
Right. So assuming your internist has tested for those kinds of things.
Right, good.
Now we're in the ballpark. We are looking at probably major depression. Then we have to decide, how much has it affected your life? Is it interfering with working, relationships, socializing? Is it getting in the way of quality of life?
Yeah, I said my clients probably don't like me as much because, you know, career counseling clients like to have people who are really upbeat and cheery and optimistic, and I tend to be flat, you know, and my wife is sick and tired of my kvetching and... you know, and I do, like I say, I walk around with my dog. You know, we take long walks in the middle of the night, you know, kind of trudging through life. That's how it affects me.
Okay, so now we're in the ballpark where we have depression, not bipolar, not medical, not substance abuse.
So this is not normal. This is I've been really quite honest. My answers were exactly who I am.
Okay.
But is that, you know, there is a normal continuum. We don't necessarily need to pathologize something. I go through life actually thinking that this is the normal way I function, and I'm somewhere on this continuum. I'm not Mr. Pollyanna, but would you diagnose this as depression?
I would say we're at the point now where we're thinking probably chronic, mild depression.
Okay, continue.
Now we want to know, is it episodic? Do you have discrete episodes of weeks or months where you go into depression, other times when you're not
depressed?
It's
pretty consistent across my life, basically. Except, you know, when there's something really fantastic that happens or something crappy. And I do. The radio show, my wife says, she comes on, she's going to be on next week. We co-host a lot. She says, you're a different person. When that red light comes on and you're on the air, it's like you're a different person. And it's not because you're being phony. It's just there's something about this that just transforms. But no, other than that, I'm a pretty flat guy.
Now we need to know, does it run in the family? Parents, brothers, sisters, grandparents.
Yes, I am my father. My father was exactly like me, 100%.
Did your father have worse depression?
No, same thing. He trudged through life, worked his butt off for his whole life, and then died.
Not bipolar, not alcoholic?
No, not at all.
Okay, so we've got familial, chronic, mild depression.
Yes.
We've got a good start on a diagnosis from
Great.
Just a few questions.
This is very useful for our listeners, right? This is
sure.
Exactly really good. So now what do you do? Let's let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Dr. Mark Zetton, co-author of the brand new book, Challenging Depression, the Go-To Guide for Clinicians and Patients. You know, you might wonder, why in the world am I doing this topic on a show that relates primarily to work? Because, as I said at the top of the show, depression is essentially the modern-day mental common cold. It is pervasive in its effects in the workplace. Probably somewhere between 5 and 15% of all people have some measure of clinically from mild to moderate or some more severe depression in the workplace. Knowing how to deal with it yourself or, and we'll get to this later, how to deal with your coworkers. You know, what if you've got a coworker who's got these signs? What should you as a good coworker, boss, supervisee do? But in the meantime, we're trying to make this feel as real as possible, give you a window into what it would really like to be seeing a world-class expert on depression, diagnose, and then treat. So now you got me as familial, chronic, mild depression, and that's probably right. Now what?
Now we talk about what form of treatment you would be willing to accept.
And let's say it wasn't a matter of whether I was willing to accept it, but you as the wise, broad-thinking person in terms of cosmically what would be right for me, my family, and the world, and I was completely a compliant patient, what would be the treatment or treatments you would recommend?
We would start talking about psychotherapy and medicines because those are the two primary treatments, and then we talk about lifestyle as a kind of tertiary treatment.
Great. Let's take it one step at it. Now, you would want to get me to use all three, or would we try to do one and then do the other?
I would look at whether you were willing to try all three of those,
okay,
because I think your best shot at getting significantly better is by doing all three.
Great. So psychotherapy comes in different flavors. There is, you know, cognitive therapy. There is psychodynamic therapy. There is their behavioral. First of all, what's the difference between cognitive and behavioral? Cognitive therapy and behavioral therapy?
They're almost always used together.
That's what I thought.
And
okay.
Cognitive therapy basically says if something happens to you, it triggers automatic thoughts, deep down assumptions about yourself that then lead you to feel depressed or anxious. For example, you know, your wife's mad at you and you say, I'm a total failure. I'm a total idiot. You know, I couldn't possibly please anybody. So overgeneralizing, thinking of negative self-image is a big part of cognitive therapy, learning to become aware of those thoughts and write them down and then test them and challenge them, change them.
Okay. And what is briefly, I love your, by the way, I appreciate your conciseness. You're doing a great job, Mark. We were talking about this off the air. You're doing great, Mark.
This Thank you.
Really, very good. So tell me about, briefly, what is psychodynamic therapy?
We didn't talk about the behavior part.
It seemed like those are not the same. Said they were spoken. Okay, good. Thank you. What is behavior therapy?
The behavioral part would mean that we're going to try to get you to schedule pleasurable activities, to expose yourself to difficult situations, to plan your life so that you're not just isolating and that you're getting out there, you're being with people, you're doing fun things, and you're doing some enjoyable hobby kinds of things. And not just staying in your room and watching TV all day.
What if I push back and say, you know, why does everybody... I know that it is the Western culture norm to be social. You even hear things like, you know, man and woman are social animals. But is there not room, without pathologizing, saying... Some people like solitude. Some people, we don't need to call them misanthropes. Some people prefer solitude. You know, if I think about spending an hour of my time on the internet, Google searching whatever I'm interested in and seeing videos and reading text about the things that I care about, how much more fascinating that is than having a chat with some random person. I get to chat about exactly what I want with the world's greatest people. Why pathologize me for saying, I'm just going to sit at home? Why is that not just a lifestyle choice rather than a pathology?
That's a wonderful choice. But you're going out and you're talking to people and interacting with people at other times. You're not doing it.
Even if I did it all the time. Let's say I eschewed people 100% of the time, and in every bit of my discretionary time, I spent it watching wonderful movies, looking at, you know, reading wonderful articles that I get off of Google, looking at YouTube videos. What's wrong with that?
If you were happy, you'd never see me. If that was satisfying to you, if that was rewarding and fulfilling, you'd never come to a psychiatrist or psychologist.
Fair point.
You just do it.
Fair point. Okay, good. So, and now we get to the third of the psychotherapeutic models, which is psychodynamic. I guess is that the fairest way to describe the third category? And describe that for us briefly.
Well, the other two are time limited. They have a manual on how to do them, and you do them for 10 or 12 sessions, and you're often done. Psychodynamic, you often go long term, and it's for people who really want insight. They want to understand why they are, who they are, how they became that way, how their childhood development influences their adult life. And they're eager for long term insight-oriented therapy that might help to change personality characteristics or relationship issues.
Isn't the danger in long-term therapy, number one, first of all, it places disproportionate weight on the causal effect of family of origin. So much of who we are is genetic. So much of who we are is experiences we've had with peers, romantic partners, etc. So much is simply intrapsychic. You know, as we start to think more about the large questions of life, etc., we are formed by that constellation of things. And when you go into psychotherapy, you know, there is the general tendency to blame, if you will, who you are disproportionately on what your mother and father did to you. Is that wrong or is that right?
Well, I think it's more understanding who you are in terms of what your mother and father did to you. And I think that the more understanding you get, the more you can change it.
But what I was saying is that may only be 10% of what makes you who you are, and yet psychotherapy tends to act like it was 90% of what causes 90% of who you are.
And I would look at it as it may help you to understand how your relationships with important people in your life are going right now, but it's not going to change your biologic symptoms of depression.
One other thing about I have had over 3,500 career counseling clients, and probably a quarter of them have had significant psychotherapy, psychodynamically oriented primarily. And I have found, and I know there's correlation-causation problems here, but I swear to you, I believe in my soul that long-term psychodynamic psychotherapy increases narcissism, self-absorption, preoccupation with one's things out of control, what their mother and father did to them, and makes them less able to move forward. Do you want to push back on that, or do you buy that?
Well, I think intensive psychotherapy focuses on the inner life, the inner experience, the inner meaning of things. And by doing that, it really focuses on what happened growing up and how that influences who you are today. That doesn't mean you can't be more aware and alive and energetic and enthused in day-to-day life.
Okay, so let's now go back to where, for the listeners who are just joining us, we are role-playing a situation where Mark Zetton, who's a world-class psychiatrist who specializes in depression, and we are role-playing what would be a first diagnostic and treatment plan session. And he has diagnosed me with mild chronic depression, familially based, and now he's saying we're going to have some kind of combination of therapy, psychotherapy, and drugs and lifestyle changes. So, and we're figuring out what, if any, kind of therapy to recommend. In my situation, what kind of therapy would you recommend and why?
Well, it would be very dependent upon whether you wanted to focus on insight and understanding or wanted to focus on controlling symptoms.
So there's no external reason to say you're more likely to have your depression significantly alleviate by this kind of therapy. It's all on me, whatever I feel like?
No, that's wrong.
Okay.
There is some very good data on cognitive behavior therapy and on interpersonal psychotherapy showing efficacy with short-term treatment for depression.
Okay.
And it is for non-psychotic, non-bipolar depression, which is what you're describing.
Right.
Where those two forms of psychotherapy have really good evidence that they work. Psychodynamic therapy does not have the controlled studies and the efficacy data that those two forms do.
So let's say I said, okay, you're sending me into cognitive therapy, 10 to 12 sessions. How do I go about, let's say I hired you as a consultant and I didn't want to use you as my therapist because I wanted an independent opinion. And I asked you, okay, what is really, as an insider, what's the smartest way for me to go pick somebody? Obviously, I'm going to call them on the phone, I'm going to chat with them, etc. But beyond that obvious thing, or ask some friends, you know, what would you say is some under-the-radar smart advice as to how I should pick a therapist?
Well, if you want a psychotherapist, you might call...
Well, isn't that what you're saying?
If you want to get a psychotherapist, you might call a few psychiatrists and ask who they think are the best people in town. You might call the department chairman at the local psychology department at UC or at Stanford and say, who's the best person for what I've got? You might go to a patient support group like the Depression Bipolar Support Alliance and ask other patients who they've worked with and thought was very good. If you were religious, you might go to your clergyman and say, who do you know who has counseled some of our members? And then you might go on the internet and look up depression psychotherapy and find who's published in the area.
What I would agree, I love the support group idea. As somebody who's a PhD from Berkeley and a professor who was on the faculty at Berkeley, I think there is an inverse correlation between the people who have published the most studies or are recommended by a department chair and the quality of the clinical work they do. The people who opt into research are narrow, arcane, abstract, theoretical, and hyper-intellectualized. They self-select for that, and they're trained in that. And therefore, they are less likely to be an effective therapist than somebody who is recommended either from your other two sources, either a patient support group, or if I go on the internet, as you say, and I get to Yelp reviews. Yelp are consuming. Some of them are put up there by competitors or whatever. But in general, if you have a large number of reviews that are positive and also describe the kind of therapist that you would want, either more directive or more reflective, that you're going to get a far better set of people to chat with initially than if you go to department chairs or look at the research publications. Do you buy that?
I think you're probably right in one sense. The researchers are often too busy writing the grants and traveling around the world to give papers to spend a whole lot of time doing clinical work. Some of them can balance that out. Others don't.
Yeah, but all things being, it's like somebody can smoke cigarettes their whole life and not get cancer, but you don't want to have the odds stacked against you, so you're going to not smoke. Same with the therapist. You're going to want to choose somebody who has not chosen to self-select into a field where they're going to live in arcana, theoretical arcana, and write research articles. I'm going to do, let's say I'm a good compliant patient, and I'm going to go and do that, but now we get to the drug thing. And let's say I say to you as a patient, I say, you know, I know about SSRI inhibitors, that they're using Zoloft and Paxil and Prozac, and, they work for some of the people, but they tend to fade out. They tend to work for a while, and they don't work, or they have side effects, and there's weight gain, which is a dirty, dark secret about antidepressants. I'm scared to death. Don't make me do this. What would you say to me?
Well, first thing is, any antidepressant we're going to try, it's just a trial. You're not committed to being on it long term. If you don't like it and you have side effects and you can't stand the stuff, we get rid of it. Move on. Try something else. Second thing I would say is we got to base it on your symptom profile and what side effects you want to avoid. Because if you tell me, I do not want to gain weight, that eliminates certain drugs. If you say, I don't want any sexual side effects, that eliminates
certain
drugs.
Let's start right there. Okay. Let's say, I don't want to gain weight and I don't want sexual side effects. What are you going to have me take?
Well, we've just eliminated Remeron. We've eliminated Cinequan. We've eliminated Elavil. If you don't want any sexual side effects, we've eliminated the SSRIs. So that means we go into a few others. An SNRI, Pristiq, looks pretty good relative to sexual side effects. Wellbutrin, Serzone, Remeron look very good relative to side effects.
What's the disadvantages? So let's say you had to pick one for us to chat about in light of what I just said. I don't want to gain weight, and I don't want sexual side effects. What's the one drug you want to start discussing with me?
Okay, I would think about Wellbutrin, bupropion, because it doesn't have weight gain or sexual side effects.
Okay, so and what are the disadvantages of Wellbutrin?
Well, if you have an eating disorder or a seizure disorder, it can trigger seizures.
Okay, those are fairly small. And again, now I'm thinking about my listeners. There's a fairly small percentage of people for whom that's a problem. What other problems exist with that? That is a choice.
A little bit of insomnia. On the other hand, some very clever folks at Loma Linda discovered if you want to stop smoking, it helps to stop smoking. So they're good and bad with each of these drugs.
I didn't really get your point. See, if you want to stop smoking, you stop smoking. How does that relate to Wellbutrin?
Wellbutrin is also marketed as Zyban, which is FDA approved for people who want to stop smoking. It helps to stop smoking.
I see. Okay. And so, you know, Wellbutrin was around a long time before the SSRIs, the Prozac, Zoloft. I mean, they called it, you know, revolution, Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil. And yet you're telling me now that you've got good efficacy. I'm not hearing a bit of possible insomnia, no weight gain, etc. Why is the Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil a revolution when there was a drug that seems to be better that existed beforehand?
Because they cover a much broader spectrum of comorbidity. Lots of people with depression.
Comorbidity exist other diseases alongside. Go ahead.
Right. So somebody with depression might also have obsessive compulsive disorder, panic disorder, social anxiety, generalized anxiety, that's chronic worry, and the SSRIs will treat that. Wellbutrin won't.
I see. So it's for people who are more generally screwed up.
Who have complex comorbidity, yes.
Okay, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Dr. Mark Zetton. He is the co-author of a brand new book published by W.W. Norton, Challenging Depression, the go-to guide for clinicians and patients. I guess that's an important question. How often is, in fact, depression the main or dominant problem that needs to be simply treated by itself? And how often are there so many of these comorbidities, general anxiety, panic attacks, et cetera, that therefore need to be treated?
I would say in primary care, probably straight depression is common. In a specialty practice, when by the time people get to a psychiatrist, a subspecialist, often they do have something else going on. They've got medical problems. They might have even psychotic symptoms. They might have severe anxiety. They might have problems with obesity or metabolic issues. And so by the time they get to a psychiatrist, they're quite likely to have a few other things going on.
I see. But for my dear listeners, probably, is it a fair statement to say that if you basically, you know, have your garden variety mild depression, not situational, and obviously if you lose your job, you get a bad diagnosis, you lost your mother, you know, to a disease, you're going to be depressed for a while, and it's, you know, it's just normal. But if you are long-term chronically sad and it is affecting your quality of life, you're not curled up all day in a bottle of vodka, but you are, you know, it's affecting your life, is it fair to say that the smartest thing to do is get some brief cognitive therapy, do a trial with Wellbutrin? Is that correct?
A trial with Wellbutrin or a trial with an SSRI.
I see. Fair enough.
Yeah, okay. Those are both frontline drugs. Now, if you have something a little bit more complicated, say you have chronic pain, you might want to go to a drug like Cymbalta. Say you have attention deficit, you might want to use Wellbutrin. Say you can't sleep at all, you have terrible insomnia and you've lost a lot of weight, you might want to use Remeron. So the spectrum of symptoms will determine the choice of first line drug.
Very good. And you said the third leg of the three-legged stool of treatment, the first one, again, for those listeners who are just joining us, the first is going to be therapy, usually 10 to 12 sessions of cognitive, rational, motor therapy kind of thing. And I'm going to pitch my friend here. I just feel like I need to do it because he's local. Dr. Michael Edelstein is an excellent cognitive therapist who specializes in depression. My guest here, I don't mean to not mention him. He's in Los Angeles. And so I'm, you know, you're welcome to call him, I guess. Do you do phone work or do you see only people in person?
I basically see people in person in Orange County.
Okay, but then you can read his book, though. It's fat, but it's very well written. And what's interesting about it is it's not just written by him. He's a psychiatrist, but he's got a couple of people with different perspectives. You've got a more alternative therapy oriented person who is a co-author, which I know for many listeners to public radio, especially here in San Francisco, will appeal. Let me ask you about that. So, candidly speaking, right now there's about 130, 150 pages of your sort of 700-page book devoted to complementary therapies from everything from St. John's wort to the aforementioned fish oil. To what extent, in your heart of hearts, do you believe it deserves as many pages as that?
Well, I probably would have given it a few less pages.
A few less? How many? If you had to pick a number, how many pages would you give out of your 700-page book to alternative and complementary therapies like that, based on real, if you were being fair, not just biased, but as fair as you could be?
Oh, probably 50 or 75.
Okay, good. And in that 50 to 75 pages of alternative therapies, and we're going to get to lifestyle changes in a minute, that third leg of the triangle, but I want to, because we just got off on this is fun. What would be the most important things you'd want to tell my listeners? My generalists, this is not a population of people who have profound multiple problems. There's a lot of people who are or know people who are mildly depressed. What would you want to tell them is most important for them to remember about alternative and complementary therapies?
Well, first thing is that they are not standardized. There is no double-blind placebo-controlled testing. There is no control on safety, efficacy, side effects, potency. What you get in the health food store, good luck. You don't know what's in that bottle. So in that sense, you're taking more of a crapshoot than you are with a prescription drug where you at least know what the side effect spectrum is. It's very well defined by very rigorous research. There's no FDA control. There is no efficacy proven for a lot of the complementary alternative therapies.
What else should I know in that 50 to 75? Because that's a negative. Is there any of the negatives or positives that you think it's fair for people who are suffering from mild depression to know about?
I think people should know about omega-3 fatty acids, which are very benign and good for your heart and
exactly.
Probably good for your depression,
too. There's no downside to it. They're really...
No downside.
I would encourage you, my dear listeners, I do take it, and I am a devotee of the Internet, and I've done some careful searching because I know there's quality control about those, too, because they're not FDA-approved. You're not going to believe who makes one of the purest and yet lowest cost versions of fish oil. Walmart. It's called Garden Valley. Is the brand that they sell, and it scores near the top of purity consistently. And so I would encourage. Mark was asking me before, do you mind mentioning brand names? No. Whatever's going to serve my listeners is what I care about. In my opinion, I'm not. You know, there's no. You check it out yourself, but. I would. I do take a 1,000-milligram Garden Valley fish oil tablet every day, just as a preventative. There you go. What else?
SAMe, S-adenosylmethionine, looks like it may help with depression by itself. It's energizing. It's available at the health food store, and there's a recent Harvard study showing that adding it to a serotonin antidepressant can boost the antidepressant effect.
Interesting. Thank you very much.
St. John's wort, another option. In Germany, it works better than in the United States because it is standardized. It is controlled. It's
more
regulated.
It's pure. It's manufactured the kind of standards that an actual drug would be, whether here where anybody can open up shop and make it as whatever they want because they've got it categorized as a food supplement rather than as a drug. Is that correct?
That's right. And then I think methylfolate or Deplin is also a really good interesting option.
Is that Deprinil? Is that what that is? Deplin. Say it again.
Deplin.
What?
Methylfolate. It's an activated form of folic acid. Some people don't have enough folic acid in their diet, and some people genetically can't convert it into methylfolate, which is the active form in the brain.
Interesting. And that's also used for, well, let me just testing my memory here. There is something called homocysteine, which is a cardiovascular bad thing. And folate is supposed to reduce
homocysteine. It reduces homocysteine, which has some,
so
benefits,
some negative benefits in addition. So
yes.
Methylfolate, huh? Okay, good. I never heard of that one before. So that's great. Anything before we leave the alternative health space, is there anything else that our general listenership would benefit to know about treating depression with something alternative-ish?
I think those are the main things.
That was fantastic. I think that was invaluable to our listeners, and I appreciate it. I want to go, let's do lifestyle change. You said, you know, you also lifestyle change is very important about in dealing with depression. Mm-hmm. Now, I know exercise is the big deal. You know, certainly I know that my mood does improve somewhat by taking that vigorous hike with my wonderful doggy Einstein, who I'm sorry, he's usually here, but he's with my wife, and so you don't get to meet him. But in any case, is that the main lifestyle change that you recommend for people with garden variety depression?
Aerobic exercise is number one.
Right.
Avoiding abusables is really the other number one, because I have so many people who come in with depression, and I'm talking to them for a little while, and I'm asking about their symptoms, and I ask about their habits. Oh, it's the bottle of wine every night to relax and get to sleep and to kind of let go of the day's stresses. That bottle of wine is adding fuel to the fire every day.
Well, there aren't that many of my listeners who are drinking a bottle of wine a day. What about the many people who have followed the old advice that was given, a glass of wine a day, red wine especially, is supposed to be healthy for you? If you have mild depression, would you recommend they stop their single glass of red wine a day?
I would be much less emphatic than if they were drinking a whole bottle, but I'd ask them to try it for a month.
I see.
And see if it made a difference.
Okay, now I want to go to the other extreme. We've been talking about the three normal legs of a treatment plan for depression, which is therapy, usually cognitive, rational, emotive kind of therapy, trial on a drug like Wellbutrin or an SSRI, and lifestyle changes like reducing or eliminating your drug and alcohol use, as well as exercise. But for in our appropriate attempt to try to get better results, because those three will get you sometimes very good results, sometimes fair results, sometimes little results. There have been more physiologically based efforts to try to address depression, from vagus nerve stimulation to transcranial magnetic resonance, which is like a magnet on your head, to some kind of a chemical knife that they use. Tell us about the physiological approaches, and dispassionately, how good are they and for whom?
Okay, we start with among these neuromodulators, the things that change brain physiology, the first and foremost was electroconvulsive therapy.
Right.
Got a bad rap for a very long time because it was done without anesthesia, without consent.
Well, the play and movie what One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest put the nail in that train treatment's coffin.
And in Berkeley, it wasn't legal for a while.
Uh-huh.
Now, that is really the ultimate, most effective treatment for the most severely depressed, treatment-resistant patients that we've got. And so I will occasionally send someone to get electroconvulsive therapy if they have severe depression, they're suicidal, they're not eating, they're not responding to meds. So
what's the method of action of that? I mean, it seems like it's such a broad brush thing. You just shock the hell out of their brain. I mean, how the heck does that work?
It probably down-regulates receptors for norepinephrine, probably changes serotonin sensitivity, but nobody really knows for sure.
It's such a bludgeon approach. My
right.
God, I so lust for all diseases, for something that really is where there's molecular action without side effects, where there's great specificity about how that drug works. These, you know, the notion, it's like the way we treat cancer, you know, with poisoning the body and pray for some specificity when in fact it's not very specific. And the same with the ECT, you know, just shocking the brain. Right? I mean, isn't that what we really need, we desperately need?
So ECT is done under anesthesia now, so it's very different from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It is very effective, but it doesn't do much to prevent recurrence and relapse. So the other neuromodulator.
So how often do you need electroshock therapy if you've got severe depression?
Well, there's a book by Kitty Dukakis in which she describes having gone for ECT several times and feeling that it was life-saving.
Yeah, okay.
People who've had very severe depressions will go into a hospital, they might get 10 or 12 treatments over a period of a few weeks. Then they may get maintenance where they get one treatment a week or one treatment every other week for a few months. often those people also need maintenance medications.
What's severe? How severe does somebody need to be before they should consider electroshock therapy? And what happens after those few months? You said a few months. Do you need to be going in for like Botox injections every 3 months to keep the wrinkles down? Or is this once you do the few months worth of getting your brain shocked a lot, you're done?
Often there's maintenance treatment, and it's given to people where they're not eating and they're losing a lot of weight, they're not getting out of bed and cleaning up themselves, they are wishing to be dead, and they are very clearly telling you that, or they are delusional. They are convinced that they're evil, terrible, God is punishing them for a sin. Those people are on the most extreme end of severe depression, and for them, ECT can be life-saving.
What? Tell me some more.
Well,
other treatments.
The other treatments. The next one that came along was vagus nerve stimulation.
Right.
Very interesting because, like many things that treat seizures, psychiatrists kind of stole it from the neurologists. We stole a lot of the anticonvulsant drugs and started using them in bipolar disorder, and they worked wonderfully. Vagus nerve stimulation was used to treat epilepsy, and it turned out it helped mood, and so we've used it in depression. It's been FDA approved, but it's not Medicare approved, so people can get it if they can pay for it, and it's very expensive. It involves implanting a stimulator in the chest wall and a wire in the neck that goes to the vagus nerve. 80% of those fibers go up to the brain, and about 1 in 4, maybe 1 in 3 people with very chronic, very severe depression will have a slow but very sustained response. And that makes it totally different from ECT, where there's a rapid, dramatic response, but it doesn't necessarily hold long-term.
When do you use ECT versus vagal nerve stimulation?
ECT is for life-threatening immediate response. Vagus nerve stimulation, the person has had chronic severe depression and failed to get better on multiple antidepressant trials.
Got it. Now, am I correct? There's so many alphabet soup and languages here, but deep brain stimulation, is that the same as vagal nerve?
No. Deep brain stimulation involves implanting electrodes in the brain. Vagus nerve stimulation, the electrode is actually in the neck.
Got it.
So deep brain stimulation is, at this point, very experimental for depression. It is FDA approved for treatment of very severe obsessive compulsive disorder. That involves putting electrodes right into the brain and then having the stimulator, the little battery pack stimulator, implanted in the chest wall. That's a pretty experimental treatment right now. Repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Before we get to that, I got to tell you, when I was a researcher at the Rockefeller University, and part of what we used to do, we were trying to, this was back in the 60s, we were trying to see if we could lower blood pressure by biofeedback. And what we did was, we did it with rats, and we implanted an electrode in a sexual part of their brain, in the hypothalamus, and gave them a real sexual charge every time they would lower their blood pressure. And every time I raised it, we gave them a pain stimulation. We had them on curare, so they were, they were immobile. It was really pretty terrible. So I would think that giving a stimulation to the sexual center of the hypothalamus would be the fastest way to cure depression. Am I wrong?
I don't think anybody's tried it in people. There's a certain ethical limitation on what you can do.
Why would it be more unethical to give people a positive sexual sensation than it would to be stimulating their vagus nerve?
Well, when you're messing with hypothalamus, you're controlling all of the basic body physiology. You're controlling just about everything in the autonomic nervous system, and you might get unintended consequences.
We did thousands and thousands of rats, and they had a hell of a time.
I'm glad the rats were
and
happy.
Their longevity was not declining, except we did kill them at the end of the experiment.
Oh, nasty.
Okay, so you were about to talk now about another kind of invasive treatment. It's not invasive. A physiologically non-invasive treatment called magnetic transcranial... I hate doctors because they use these fancy words. Transcranial immediately means around the top of the brain. I mean, this is like you're just putting like a headband on that gives you a magnetic impulse. Is that correct?
Transcranial means it goes through the cranium, through the
right.
skull.
Okay, all
and
right.
it's yeah. pulsing magnetic stimuli going through the skull to the surface of the brain. When you pulse a magnetic field, you get an electric field induced. And by inducing electric field in the surface of the brain, you can treat depression. Now, that one has been also FDA-approved, but generally not paid for by most insurance companies. The approval was for people who failed one adequate antidepressant trial. So it's not for the really chronically treatment-resistant patient, the way vagus nerve stimulation is, and it's not for the very severely ill patient the way ECT is.
But it would seem like it would be a cheap and low-risk technique. It has shown efficacy in some people. I went in preparing for this show. I went to the Mayo. I Googled it, and then the Mayo Clinic has a website where they describe it. They describe it as expensive. Why would something like that be expensive?
Well, A, the machine costs about $60,000 to get one in the office.
Why? Just again, this is my ignorance.
It's very high tech.
But it's just really basically, I'm thinking about if I'm the businessman, all I'm really doing is I'm creating this set of magnetic impulses of certain specified intensity. Why shouldn't that be a cheap machine?
Well, you have to really blast electricity through the magnets at a very high current very quickly to induce a high-level magnetic field very fast, and then to turn it off very fast. You have to cool the magnet, and unfortunately, the part that actually goes next to the patient is disposable. It can only be used once.
Why?
And the company was very clever, I guess.
But that seems ridiculous. I mean, I've been very fortunate as a career counselor. I've dealt with people from all walks of life, including these money in their eyes, stars in their eyes, VC-type guys who come up with this idea that really only costs $50 to produce if they were really trying to just, produce it cost-effectively, but they figure out how to charge $80,000 because they know that it's all covered by insurance and the insurance companies will pay. And
Well, this is not covered by insurance a lot of the time because it's fairly new technology. It costs about $10,000 to have a series of TMS treatments over about a month. And most people would say that's largely because of the equipment is very expensive, and the non-reusable patient interface.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Dr. Mark Zetton. He's the author of Challenging Depression, the go-to guide for clinicians and patients. By the way, I love my listeners at KLW. Somebody caught me in an error, and I want to correct it. It's not Garden Valley. It is called Spring Valley. The Walmart fish oil that is highly regarded is not Garden Valley. It is Spring Valley is the brand. Okay. You mentioned parenthetically about 10 minutes ago, but I remember because it was particularly interesting. You talked about some people with depression, it's their religion. The guilt is religiously based. You know, here in the Bay Area, we're the land of atheism. The only people who, people seem like the only people who are religious here are Buddhists. But, or Bujus. A lot of Jews are Buddhists. Anyway, how often is depression caused by religion-induced guilt? I think it's fair to say that Christianity is a very guilt-centric religion, especially Catholicism. How often in the year 2010 do you hear about, read about, see in your practice people whose depression is either caused in part or completely by religious guilt?
In my experience, that's fairly rare. Okay. I really don't see that. I see people who might feel guilty about something that they have done, but seldom is that the central issue in triggering a depression.
Okay. We're getting to the end here. I'm looking at, when I love this, I prepared about a dozen questions, and as I told my guest before I started, I asked the first question, then we have a conversation. We've had this lovely 43-minute conversation, and I have not even looked at my question sheet until now. So before I let you go, I want to see if there's anything I wrote on my questions that I really feel is important to ask you, or whether we covered that which is most really important. Okay. Yeah, let's move to the future. Let's talk about the future of depression. We're talking about some efficacy, but there was a study cited in your book, I believe, by Sullivan, Neal, and Kendler that found that 40% of predisposition to major depression is hereditary. What is the implications of that for today's patients, and what is the implications of that for what needs to be researched?
The implication for today's patient is if you walk into my office with depression, the first thing I'm going to ask you to do as homework is call your mother, father, brother, sister, anybody who's had depression, find out what their diagnosis was, find out if they were bipolar, if they were alcoholic, if anyone suicided, and most importantly, find out what they got better on. Because if your mother got better on something, I want to know it. I want to try it on you.
Dear listeners, that's a gold mine right there. If you are suffering from it doesn't have to be depression. We like to think in America that if you work hard enough, you can conquer anything. It is almost a motto. It would be under the American flag. You work hard and you can accomplish anything. But the reality is we are significantly a product, both of our genes and our environment. And therefore, you must, especially if you are suffering from something, you must find out what is the genetic, not just the genetic cause, because all things, find to know your parent or your two uncles got it, But the great thing that Mark said is, what worked to help or cure it? That is a magical question. Agree?
Yes. Now, the next thing that I would tell that person is, warn your kids when they are teenagers. Around teenage years is when depression often starts, or after having a first baby. You tell those kids, if you get into substance abuse, if you start getting depressed, if you have a first child and you experience depression, don't wait to get it treated. It runs in our family. It is very treatable. Don't just let it go. Don't think this is just a moody teenager and let it fester for years. Get it treated quickly.
Gold again. I'm going to repeat it merely because I want to make sure that everybody's heard it. I think that is brilliant. It's multi-generational. If you are suffering from a disease, physical or psychological, psychological often has physiological roots, of course, you are to be multi-generational about it. You are to ask your parents what the parents and other close relatives, biological relatives, what they have suffered from and what helped. And you are then to the next generation, to your children, say, hey, I have this. It has a genetic component to it. If you're experiencing this now or in the future, start. Don't just think it may just be the blues, but it may not. At least get an evaluation from some non-ideologue, not somebody who's designed to over-pathologize or over-treat, but get a fair-minded look at it so that you can address it before it overwhelms you. Is that a fair way to say?
Yes.
Okay.
And there's one other thing about the future, and that is gene chips are becoming more and more available in research centers, and probably in the next decade we will have some good genetic markers of depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and probably in the next decade we'll have some good genetic markers of what people can potentially respond to, so we don't have to do the kind of trial
exactly.
and error we talked about earlier.
That brings us full circle. That would be the dream. And I would imagine that if I gave you a $50 million NIMH grant, that you would be trying to find what are those genetic, you said, not just markers for the presence of the disease, but markers for what kinds of molecule by molecule treatments would address that person's particular disease. Is that correct?
Yes. You gave me $50 million, and I'll start looking at all the technology we have for looking at the biology of depression. I'll look at SPECT scans. I'll look at PET scans. I'll look at functional MRI. I'll look at neuroendocrine markers. I'll look at computerized EEGs. I'll look at gene chips, and I'll say, okay, I can spend thousands of dollars working up a patient who walks in the door with depression. Now, with all of those tests available, do any of them really help me to do a better job in getting them well?
There are millions of people listening to this show, not millions, but I mean there's large numbers of people listening to this show who have either have or are having long-term psychotherapy as the primary way of dealing with their depression. This show gets a lot of listeners who are psychotherapists themselves who do focus on psychodynamics. Much of what you're saying says that the present of treatment of depression and by extension most psychological illnesses would be best treated through the combination of drugs and behavioral and cognitive therapy and some lifestyle changes, and the future is going to be ever more physiological. What do you say to those countless listeners to the show who are either current or past patients of traditional psychotherapy, that is psychodynamic therapy, family-related psychotherapy, as well as the many psychotherapists who are listening to this show?
That there used to be a war between the psychotherapists and the psychopharmacologists. They used to play tug of war. This patient should get to the root cause of their problems, or this patient should have their symptoms controlled. I think that turf war has gone away. I think what's happened in the last 10 or 20 years with the popularization of a lot of the psychiatric meds, starting with the SSRIs, has been a much more collaborative approach that says the pharmacology can control symptoms. Psychotherapy can begin by dealing with immediate crises and then move into dealing with long-term issues of coping with life's difficulties.
But primarily the cognitive rather than the psychodynamic, is that correct?
I think what's happened is that the cognitive behavior approach has kind of emerged as the dominant force in American psychotherapy because it is so data-based, because it is manualized, and because it's short-term, which makes it affordable.
Let me ask you one last softball open-ended question. We've now been talking 50 minutes, and we've shared, I think, a wealth of information for both people who are suffering from depression, but also just for the general listenership. But if there's one thing you either want to repeat that you've already said, or one thing you haven't yet said that you think our listenership, the general listenership, should hear, what is it?
There is no degree of depression suffering that justifies suicide. Depression is a treatable illness.
And I thank you. That's a great way to end. Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Zetton, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
The book is Challenging Depression, the go-to guide for clinicians and patients. And now, my dear listeners, we only have 9 minutes left. I didn't know how, you know me. I tend on average to keep my guests on for 30 minutes. But, you know, if I like him, if he's, I feel he's serving you, we keep him on longer. I like this guy. I thought he did a good job, real good job. So we only got a few minutes, but I profoundly care to help you. If you have a problem of any sort, whether it be depression-related but mainly career-related, any kind of career problem, I am here to help you. The phone number here for what I call a three-minute career makeover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, I was, wasn't surprised about this. I saw that CNN came up with a list of the America's 10 most dangerous jobs. And as a men's advocate, feeling that while I'm an advocate for women too, I feel that today men are getting screwed in the way they're perceived in the media. I look at those dangerous jobs. America's most dangerous jobs are all dominated by men. Fisherman, logger, airplane pilot. And we're not talking about 747s here. We're talking primarily, you know, the rescue pilots and bush pilots and et cetera. Farmers and ranchers, they die of diseases from drinking all those chemicals. Roofers, iron workers, sanitation workers. Those are the most dangerous jobs. There's the most illness and the most deaths. And yet, and in the military, all we talk about is the men and women who serve in Iraq. 99.5% of the deaths occurred to men. It's time we be fair. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air.
Marty, it's Erica Lopez. Do you remember me?
I do remember you, Erica. How are you?
Hey, I loved your show today. And one of the things that I love, and I hope you do more on depression, because as you know, the last 10 years of mine have been really depressed. And I've just come out with my own project. But what I do hear from you and in seeing what you do and what you've been doing for a long time is I think that a lot of people are fighting with feeling irrelevant, and things are changing. And so when you feel irrelevant and you don't know what the new games are and the new rules are, I think that that's...
What a brilliant point. I want to try to riff off of that. Feeling irrelevant, right. Everybody feels unless you've developed a new iPhone app or you are designing a new photovoltaic solar panel, you are like out the pasture.
Right.
What I believe is, while that may be true in a capitalist society where it is pretty tough to prevail, I believe an antidepressant we haven't discussed is the arts. I profoundly believe that there is a strong creative instinct in so many people. I'm a blogger. I'm a writer. I am much less sad when I am producing, creating. I would encourage everybody who is feeling irrelevant, whether you want to define it as accompanied by depression or not, to ask yourself, what is your creative outlet? Is it to paint? Is it to draw? Is it to help somebody else? Is it to save a life of a doggy?
But it's not even just that. What you said when you were on with Mark is that you feel most alive right now when you've got your 1 hour a week.
Yeah, it's true.
And that's because you're actually communicating and you're listening and you have no idea what's going to happen and it's all spontaneous. And
it's because I feel like I have the biggest chance to make a difference. I know that there are 7,000 people who will, if I am at my best, if I am good, I will make a difference. And I'm using my best skills. I can think on my feet. That is, I have many weaknesses. But my strength is I can think well on my feet, and I get to use my best skill in something that's pro-social.
Oh, you're brilliant on the radio. I mean, so that's what I think a lot of, and that's what my last 10 years of depression was about, was feeling like I'm at my best, I have all these skills, but they're not marketable with the industry and publishing. And now all the people that I pitched to have been fired. David Rosenthal's been fired. All my editors that I was sending stuff to have all been fired.
Erica, then blog. Because blog enables you instantly to be published, and if it's any good, you will get a certain number of readers. I started out with no readers in my blog. I now have 500,000 a year.
Right.
And even if you only get 100 or 50, the feeling that you can say what you want to say without the censorship of an editor,
exactly,
and get it out there, even to 5 people, is an antidepressant. Erica, I want to get a couple of more calls.
Okay,
thanks very much for calling. Love you. Bye. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air.
That's me?
It is.
Oh, hi. I just wanted a couple things. One, I think it's really good to talk about depression because it's a dirty little secret. And it's one of those things that people feel guilty. They feel guilty about being depressed, you know, and then the next thing you know, but if you talk about it and get it out in the open, I think it's a lot better.
I know. Isn't that crazy? You know, nobody feels guilty about having diabetes. You know, it's something or get cancer. You know, depression is a largely physiologically caused thing. It's a disease that you should feel no more guilty about.
And also you have to ask yourself, speaking about capitalism, if you've got some incredible percentage of people who are depressed or self-medicating with alcohol and drugs, mm-hmm. then it's not, you know, the idea that it's always the individual's problem or the individual's issue. But if you've got a society where you've got what percentage of people alcoholic, you know, on drugs or, pharmaceutical or not, then, you know, sometimes you have to step back and say, well, is it really me, the individual? Or
hey,
is it like,
but the
what's
problem
going
is,
on in the real
the
world?
Problem is that, you know, you look in communist Russia, where you didn't have the capitalist thing, you had huge alcoholism problems.
Yeah.
You know, as Churchill said, capitalism is the worst form of government except for everything else.
Yeah, I'm not blaming it, but I'm just saying just in general. The other thing I have to say is one of the things that my friends have always told me is that at least I know what makes me happy, which for me is bike riding and yoga. Mm-hmm. And somebody said to me, you know, the most important thing is if there's something that you do that makes you happy, that you enjoy, then just do lot more of it.
I disagree with that.
Sometimes, of course, when you're depressed,
I think happiness is overrated. I think that ultimately you live the life more well-led if your aim is not happiness but to make a difference.
Well, things that you enjoy, then I'm not.
It doesn't have to be enjoyed. For example, Mother Teresa.
Really,
I'm going to interrupt you because we're out of time.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Mother Teresa was not happy when she was in the streets of Calcutta in the sweltering heat with putting flies off her, but she did live the life well-led and felt good, and she was not depressed because she was making a difference. So I think happiness, to yoga or whatever, ultimately feels empty. People who just seek pleasure, they could have sex all day, watch Marx Brothers movies all day, and do yoga all day, and ultimately they will feel empty and likely to be depressed. If they have that predisposition. It is far wiser, as Carl Menninger, the great psychotherapist, psychiatrist, said in 50 or 80 years ago when somebody in one of his speeches said, you know, I have a patient who's very, very depressed, very depressed. What kind of therapy do you recommend? And he says, you know what the best therapy for that person would be? Have them help somebody else. If you get out of your narcissistic self and you do try to help others, that combination, helping others and creative expression, in my judgment, are the two ancillary treatments to depression that we have not yet discussed and are the great capstone for the show. That is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I'm sorry, all the lines are loaded up. I gotta go. My thanks to my board operator, Joanne Marr, to all of you for listening and calling in again, to Mark Zetton and his lovely wife, Linda, who's joined us from L.A., author of Challenging Depression. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers. And my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and I are going to debate, should America have a 30-hour work week? We're going to take both sides of the debate. Each of us is going to take both sides of the debate. It should be very fun. I'm also going to lay out my top 10 ways to improve the world. Join me until next Sunday. This is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.